The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. As you probably can tell by the voice, that this is not Dan Proft. My name, I'll be sitting in for Dan, is Scott Shelody. You probably won't even know that either, but I'm more commonly referred to as the cow guy. You'll catch me on a bunch of different financial news networks, you know, Fox being the main one, but I'll do some CNBC Europe and Bloomberg and TD Ameritrade and the likes, and I usually am, you know, talking about public policy, a lot of things that Dan talks about on his show and also the markets. But I'm here to kind of dive right in and get started today, and it's a great way to start the week. And I've also learned in this business that you don't say Dan's on assignment, right? He's either scuba diving in Florida or surfing in California, but he's on assignment, so we don't actually really know where he's at. But what a week, right? We just got through with the second impeachment, the second. You know, the fruitless exercise, and for all the his misdeeds and his bad behavior, this whole thing was it was vindictive, and I write about that in one of the things I write in the Northwest Indiana Times here in the Midwest. Not that big of a paper, but not that small of a paper either. And I write a Sunday article, and you know, here's where we're at, right? This is the direct result of when you vote against something and not for something. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm also in the business world. That's why I'm on those television shows. I comment a lot on how public policy affects business. But when you're against something all the time, that's a lot different. And when you vote against something, that's a lot different than voting for something. And this is the direct result. This is what you get. You get everybody, it's the politics of no, everybody upset about everything. They don't want to do this. They don't want to do that. But they don't know what they do want to do, right? So when you come into my office and you say, hey, I don't like the way the company's going. I don't like this direction. I don't like what we're selling. I don't like this price. That's fine. Great. Thank you very much for your input. What's your solution? Don't come in here and just tell me how bad things are. Come in here and tell me how bad they are, and this is what I would do about it. But we don't get that from the left. And if we do get it from the left, this is what we get. See, from my upbringing on the right side of the aisle, I come from a point that where the country's generally good, right? Americans are good people. We don't have this divide that I think that everybody's been led to believe. When you're in line at Starbucks, do you care who's in front of you and who's behind you really? I mean, you got lives. We don't have this social unrest as much as I think the media would like you to. Yes, does it happen? Sure. Are there bad cops every now and again? Sure. Are there bad NFL football players every now and again? Sure. But I don't believe that it's inherently a bad place. And neither do the thousands and tens of thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of people that are trying to come across our southern border. If it was that bad of a place, if it was so racist and misogynistic and fascist and whatever you think it is, why do all these people want to come in? We're not putting up a border to keep people out. And so I come from that point of view where things are good, generally good. And yes, can we improve? Absolutely. Right. But the other side of the aisle comes with everything. This is horrible. We need to burn it down and start over. And we need to build it up into what we like and what we think it should be. Build back better. Does that sound familiar to you? Build back better the way I envision things to be. And I think that's the problem. I don't have the negative point of view of America that they do. America is an inherently bad place that they need to tear down and build back up the way they think it should be. And who cares what the founding fathers wanted versus my side? Look, I think it's a great place. That's why everybody still wants to be here. And I love my country and I love my flag. And I'm patriotic that way, too. And that's the problem. So when you're against something, you're not for anything. And that is how we find ourselves in the position we're at today, right? They don't like – they voted against Donald Trump. They didn't vote for Joe Biden. That's a problem. Because now you have to wake up and you think, okay, I got that guy out. Orange man bad. He's done. He's gone. Whatever. Now what do I have? Now we've got a guy that in his first few days – he signed more executive orders than he's been in office, days in office. That doesn't sound like a dictator if you ask me. Not. But he signs away the Keystone XL pipeline, okay? Now, to every nonpartisan environmentalist, it's a lot safer to do it with the pipeline than it is to put it on trains and trucks. And if you're worried about the environment, you'd put it in the pipeline. But because Donald Trump wanted to do it, we're getting rid of it. 11,000 guys, not including all the jobs up and down that pipeline and all those small towns. I'm sure you've seen them on the television like I have. But there's a consequence, a knock-on effect. Nope, that was his idea. We're getting rid of it. I don't care. If it was cancer, if he cured cancer and it was his idea, we'd get rid of it too. So they're always against something, right? And then if they are for something, I think it can be very dangerous too. I mean, the one time they are for it, it's the $15 an hour minimum wage, federal minimum wage. You know, there's places that just couldn't handle it. I mean, my mother ran a small shop when I was a kid. If she had to have everybody paying getting $15 an hour, it would be closed today, right? And this is not just because it was back in the day. You know, you can index that to what people were getting paid back then, and it would be closed. But that's another symptom, right? They're always after solving the symptom, not the problem. And I'll tell you, love them or hate them, when you get your unemployment rate down to the mid-3.5s, 3.4, whatever it was at its low here in the U.S. before COVID hit, you don't hear anybody complaining about a federal minimum wage. There's nobody that's arguing. If you're up by 4 touchdowns in the huddle, nobody's arguing about who gets the ball next. Because everybody, we're winning. So when you've got a 3.5% unemployment rate, you're not talking about a federally mandated minimum wage. That only comes up when things aren't good. It doesn't come up when things are great. So you see where I'm going here? It's when things, when you do want to solve something, you're treating a symptom. You're not treating the problem. And generally speaking, you just don't want to solve anything. You just want to complain. And that doesn't get anybody anywhere. So that's my big problem with the whole scenario is that you come to my office, you can complain all you want. I get it. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes every single day. But don't come in here and tell me how stupid I am without telling me a better way to get it done. Because that doesn't do anybody any good. And then to surround yourself by people that are just going to say yes to you all the time isn't going to get us anywhere either. So that's been my biggest problem with, what is your end game? What do you want this to look like? I mean, what do you want the world to look like when you want to let men compete against women in female sports? Talk to me about that. I can't believe that you're that overly sensitive that you can't say that doesn't smell right, right? It's, I own the website Common Sense Grad, or the URL commonsensegrad.com, because I think that there's going to be some room for this coming soon, because the left is trying to tell you, don't believe your eyes and don't believe your ears. Do not believe what you're seeing and do not believe what you're hearing. Believe what we're telling you, and then when you're done with that, we're going to start modifying your behavior, okay? It's not just what to think, or not just your behavior, it's going to be what you think, right? Thoughts and behavior are going to be their big two things they're going to go after. Because they've gotten a lot of people, what happens when you've been told time and time again, don't believe what you see, don't believe what you hear? It's unsettling, because those two are basic tenets of life. If I'll see it when I believe, I'll believe it when I see it, right? Everybody said that before. It's a mostly peaceful protest, never mind the inferno behind me. They're trying to upset you because it's easier to move in and take control amidst the chaos of your mind when you're starting to doubt yourself about what you're seeing and what you're believing. And on top of that, they're not even doing any backroom deals about it. They're doing it right out in front of your very eyes. And you say to yourself, I can't believe they're doing this. What did they do? What? No, we're going to have people that are born men compete with women, like it or not. And if you don't like it, we're going to cancel you. dox you, it's over. What is your alternative? Where do you go in this world? How do we get to what you and I would say is just a commonsensical? You know, look, if I've got an agricultural background, that's why they call me the cow guy, right? If you go outside and it's raining, you're not pulling the tractor out. It's raining. But the left's going to sit there all day long and try to tell me it's not raining. No, you have to trust yourself. And I think that the last 4 years, I think a lot of people on the right have slowly but surely learned, you know, this doesn't smell right. We can't get anybody to cover Hunter Biden. We can't get anybody to cover really anything that hurts the left's agenda. That doesn't smell right to me. I don't care if you call it a new show, an opinion show, or whatever. If you're not covering it, you're not covering it. So nothing to see here. Don't believe what you see. Your eyes are telling you and what your ears are telling you. Move along now. We'll tell you how to behave and we'll tell you how to think. That's where we're at when you vote against something rather than for something. And that's the problem that we're going to have to deal with for the next 4 years or 3.5 years. And it's going to be an uphill battle.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Great. Well, welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Shelley filling in for Dan, the smartest guy that I know. Well, he's not that smart because he's got me filling in for him. How's that sound? I'm Scott the Cow Guy. Although you'll find me on Fox, and I do some public policy speaking and the economy and markets. But what's great about being on this show is it's a lot of it's public policy. And the public policy has, over the last year, has stunk. And we're going to be judged very harshly in 10 years' time. Again, I'll say it over and over, for how poorly we've handled ourselves. And I can't say it or boil it down more than you had your first of all, they decided what jobs were essential, which I think is criminal. I mean, when we all need money to survive, everybody's job is essential. I'm not waiting for my governor to tell me it is or it isn't. But that being said, they took away your ability to work. They took away your ability to assemble or congregate. And they turned your house into a cell. And there's going to be so much damage on the other side of the ledger. We spent so much time worrying about the people that may or may not be getting the virus. And depending on what your age is, the CDC says basically if you're under the age of 65, you've got a 99.6% chance of surviving the virus if you get it. I mean, I think 85% of the deaths were over the age of 70 years old. And we should have looked after the old people, and like they didn't in New York, and we should look after those that have got some sort of comorbidity or an issue that's going to make them especially vulnerable. But we can't shut the economy down. And going back to the stimulus, you know, we don't have the money. We just don't have the money. Everybody should get a pink pony, a pink unicorn too, right? I mean, might as well. We just don't have the money. And we are bankrupting my great-great-grandchildren for a dumb idea. Where we need to get everybody back to work, we can't afford to continue to go down this path of shutdown stimuli, shutdown stimulus. We're broke, and that's the problem. So, I don't know why. I know that people were scared, and maybe it's because we're lazy. I don't know, but we didn't do our homework in the beginning. We let other people tell us, right? That's that old adage. You should read the news. Don't listen to your news, right? Because they're going to tell you what they want you to hear. And unfortunately, we had all the COVID death tolls. When you shut down your economy, you have a poorer economy. And studies prove that the poorer the economy that you have, the sicker your constituents, because you'd have got no money. So by shutting your economy down to make people healthier, it flies in the face of common knowledge. And that's what I tell people all the time. I mean, I'm a fiscal conservative. I lean to the right, right? I'm not by any means a Democrat or a progressive, God forbid. But I feel more like I'm a common sensocrat, and I say that as a joke, and Dan laughs every now and again when I put it up. But I mean it enough that I bought the URL, right? So commonsensegrad.com is mine. And maybe there's a spot for that in the next few years because, you know, they put us in that in that pot of boiling, or not pot, that pot of warm water as frogs, and just turned up the boil, and we never hopped out. We never opened up our restaurants en masse like we should have. We had a few brave souls that kept their gyms open or kept their bar, or but they because they were only one or two, the government could use the full force of what they had to absolutely squelch these people. And while they made a gallant effort, and rightfully so, it's like you're going to go out of business anyway. You might as well go down fighting, and they chose to go down fighting because a lot of these businesses aren't coming back. And I say that over and over again, but nobody really can grasp the idea of this wealth transfer from all the small mom-and-pop shops that can't put in their business plan, being closed for 8 months and paying all their people and their rent too, versus the big corporate chains that can. I mean, it's just not – and so, yeah, Burger King can stay locked. They can stay closed. So can McDonald's. But the corner Italian pizza joint or the Chinese joint, they can't. And then, number one, so now they're gone. And so now we're going to have no diversity, and all that money is going to go to the bigger corporation. And then we're just going to have these big box stores too, right? Because they're essential. Menards is essential. Going to church is not. Strip clubs are essential. Liquor stores are essential. But school is not. I mean, does anybody not see the hypocrisy? And if you do, you should be doing cartwheels in anger because they're going to judge us so harshly. And we need to stand up because, again, I don't know how many times I have to say it, but we've just put the blueprint on how to take over America up on the bulletin board. You go through it. It's only a couple pages long, but it just basically starts off with scare them with a virus. And, folks, I don't care what anybody tells me, we didn't have the money to shut down. All we needed to do was to say, even back before we knew very much about anything, if you're afraid, don't go outside, and don't see anybody else that's been outside. That's it. Quarantine yourself. By locking down a few, that's quarantine. By locking down everybody, that's tyranny. And everybody took it so well. I'm just still so shocked. And granted, March, April, May, when they're beating you over the head with all of those death counts every single day, there was times where I actually looked at myself in the mirror thinking, am I going down this rabbit hole the wrong way? I mean, is this going to be the end of me? Because I have been saying that the deaths and destruction on the other side of the ledger are going to be greater than what COVID actually does because of their long lasting, right, folks? That the sexual assaults they don't end mentally when we find the coronavirus is under control. That person will be scarred for the rest of their lives. For the rest of her life, she's going to be scarred forever. That's not going away when we find a cure. All of those things. And we can't bring back all those people that have committed suicide. I've had friends commit suicide because of the failure of businesses. And so we're only looking at one headline Hollywood aspect of this problem, and we are going to be judged very harshly. So we got to get that economy back up and running. We don't need to spend any more money on stimulus. We just need to say we're open and we're welcome to having you in. That's all it's got to be. And because at the end of the day, we argue about what you like. The government doesn't make money, right? The government redistributes money. They take your taxes from you, and then they give it to other people. I mean, that's it. The government's not a business. Everybody's got to remember that. And right now this business is running at a deficit. They've taken dollars from people that haven't made them yet. And that's where we stand. This is how we're going to get out of this problem, by bankrupting my great-great-grandchildren. That doesn't seem right. They didn't do anything. They didn't act wrong. And that's the biggest problem I've got with it all. And we're arguing about how big these stimulus and open the economy up. It's just that simple. It is just that simple. The cases are way down. The deaths are still way down. We're getting there. Just do it. We didn't lock the country up in 1969, nor did we over the Spanish flu in 1918, 1919. But for some reason, we've got the luxury of everybody working from home, so we're going to lock down, and we're the worse off for it. We're not better for it. And there's going to be a lot of scarring that we're going to find out in years to come. I'll be back after this. And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business every way. I've been taking care of business. It's all mine.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft. And this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Shelley, otherwise known as the Cow Guy. I used to. The pits are gone now, right? We've automated everything. It's way better. I used to wear a black and white Holstein cow jacket because we have a family dairy farm. I wore that in the pits to trade and garnered a little bit of attention because I'm a little bigger than the average guy. But it was a way to get that attention, to get your business done. But anyway, here I am in for Dan Proft. Dan is on assignment, and I've been lucky enough to get called in to meet his guests and have a chat. And I love doing it because I feel pretty very strongly about a lot of these things that we talk about on the show, and I talk about them on television as well. But our next guest is a gentleman by the name of Kurt Mills, a senior reporter at the American Conservative. He's our go-to impeachment guy, I think. And at least that's what I'm led to believe. And Kurt, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Meg.
Okay, Trump dodges and he's 2-0, right? And I guess Nancy's 0-2. But what are your views? I mean, where do we go from here? What are your thoughts? Open mic time. Let me have it because I've got a lot to say too.
Well, he's undefeated in the way that O.J. Simpson was once.
right.
His critics would say, but, you know, eventually it caught up to him as well. But I will say that impeachment is a cross-section between a legal and political process. So the framers of the Constitution recognize that the president has this sort of pardon power. It's unclear if the president can even pardon himself. And so accordingly, there had to be a sort of trial mechanism that only the president could be subjected to, i.e. impeachment. Now there are other federal officials can be impeached, but this is the big shebang. And especially problematic with this process is that the fact that the jurors were the victims of the crime itself, right? Like,
yep.
You ever imagine, basically a terrorist attack where the jurors were the people in the towers or something like that. So,
right.
You know, it's fairly extraordinary circumstance. You know, my own view is that Trump obviously has his fair share of responsibility for what happened on January 6th. It wouldn't have happened without Donald Trump. It wouldn't have happened without Trump contesting the election. And he contested the election in a pretty feckless and reckless manner. The specific charge was incitement. I wasn't a juror. Not a senator, but, you know, I think he could have gone either way, which he literally incited a mob. And so obviously, you know, 43 other Republican senators felt the same way, and he was acquitted.
Okay, so where do you stand on just impeachment as a process in the whole? I mean, it just seems to me to be every time now we disagree with something politically,
uh-huh.
Okay, you're going to be impeached, or we're going to try to impeach
you. Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's certainly – I mean, look, if you look at it, I'll say two things. If you look at Trump's presidency – there were basically three main scandals, two of which resulted in impeachment and acquittal. There was Russia, there was Ukraine, and then there was the Capitol Hill. And I think that the president and his allies justifiably felt as if the Russia thing was a jam-up, but there really wasn't much evidence there, and it was designed to assume the majority of his presidency, which it frankly did, and that they sort of built this victim complex around their actions from there on. I think Ukraine got dicier, frankly. The president was obviously concerned about Biden and was trying to interfere charitably in the domestic politics of Ukraine to try to get information about Biden. I think that there was a tighter race. And then this last one, I think, was actually not as close, even though it was worse for the United States of America as such. In terms of impeachment and these sort of dueling impeachments and these dueling inquisitions that could theoretically come about when power changes hands, yeah, I mean, that's how Brazil rolls. And I don't think that's the best model.
Well, I mean, look, I lean to the right. I'm not crazy right, but
yeah.
I do I do believe that a lot of the things the left, or at least the progressives, get their hands on, they cheapen, they dilute, right? I mean, they've cheapened or diluted the whole impeachment thing now, right? So now it's a thing where before it was a really big deal, right? Now it's like, okay, whatever, impeach me, because they've gotten their hands on it and they've cheapened it, and I think that they do that a lot on the left when they get their hands on stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a mess, and you know, there has been some discussion of even impeaching Kamala Harris, and I think the sort of fringe Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced, I believe she introduced articles against President Biden. This occurs to me that this is sort of the triumph of the fringes in the main
say
of American politics. Yeah, I mean, if you remember, look, I don't think George W. Bush was much of a president, but you know, back 15 years ago, you know, the people trying to impeach Bush or Dick Cheney were always the backbenchers from lunatic districts. It wasn't the leadership of the parties.
Right. I think you know we'll come back to that. That's a great point. We're going to take this moment to take a quick break, pay some bills, and we'll be back after that.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Sheldy, otherwise known as the Cow Guy. And you know, when I say it like that, it sounds really corny. But it's the brand, and I'm an accidental commentator because of it. But anyway, we're on with Kurt Mills, senior reporter at the American Conservative, and we've been talking about Russia, the Ukraine, Capitol Hill, and in the impeachment, and what the left may or may not, or progressives at least. I don't want to put all the left in, but I mean, how they can dilute things when they get they start to use them as a club more often than not. And we kind of left it off there, and you know, it just seems to me now that that's going to be the word every time I disagree with you. Let's impeach you. You know, that's going to be the go-to thing now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a major problem. Look, the founders are pretty bright guys. You can take or leave the United States. You can say it's imperfect, it's flawed, but they really devised this system of all these checks and balances in order to, you know, steer us towards our better angels, as one can put it, right? And I think there are a lot of unwritten norms that keep us from being a, frankly, a banana republic. And I think we run the risk of that when we get into the over-criminalization of politics. That is, that if you get involved in public life, your chance of being indicted or impeached or having your reputation utterly destroyed and unable to get another job, it's approaching one. I think that's a real problem for American civic life, and I think it's something that we should be discouraged, frankly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the cancel culture. That's the doxing. I mean, if you want to run for office, you could be the best guy in the world, make one mistake 20 years ago, and then boom, you're out. You can't do it. I mean, and so then we water it down to only these few people that have never made a mistake, but then generally speaking, that means they've never taken a chance or they've never put...
Well,
you know,
Trump is this weird confounding variable, though, right, where he like actually made all these mistakes and people seem to kind of back him because he just took it.
Right.
So it's like, I mean, look, he hasn't lived a flawless life.
No, of course not. But I think one of the more interesting articles I read, and I can't remember who wrote it, but he was like the first rapper before rappers, right? I mean, he was the one that glorified the gold, and the joke was that he flew over to England to help the Queen decorate the inside of Buckingham Palace, right?
Right?
So,
right. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's dated hundreds of women, and not that there's anything wrong with that, and you know, multiple marriages and multiple bankruptcies. And,
not that I'm jealous, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it is interesting that he sort of had this sort of like nascent support within the African American music community. You know, all these rappers sort of liked him. You know, he is this sort of sense. That he is the sense sort of a American gangster figure for better or worse.
He threw it in everybody's face, you know. He was brash that way. It was very, very interesting to me. But you know, him aside, I mean, it does kind of really limit who we can have to run the country if you can't have anything in your background that would have been even considered, you know, anywhere near a failure and or slightly
right.
Dubious. I mean, where does that leave us with? We're not going to have any
leaders. Well, it's going to be. I'm 30, so I mean, I'm just telling you, it's going to be way different when, you know, the average politician is my age, when everything is absolutely archived online, on Facebook, et cetera. And then I think it's even worse for people about 10 years younger than me who don't know any other existence other than, you know, having iPhones in their pockets and, you know, just graduated college in a pandemic. So it's going to be screwy.
I wrote this weekend in the Northwest Indiana Times about how I'm older. I'm 55, right? So my first election that I could vote for was for Ronald Reagan, and I dutifully did so. Mm-hmm. But that was around the time that President Biden lifted a speech from a guy by the name of
Neil Kinnock,
the leader of the Labour Party out in England, and just for that to happen, for him to get caught, part of the article was that is terribly unlucky because he said it to a bunch of different people in a different crowd in a different country. And somebody gives it to Biden, and he says it to a bunch of people in Des Moines, Iowa. I was born in Des Moines, right? I'm not saying that's a bad place. It's just kind of out of the way again. And then not having the internet, how does he get caught? I mean, it's just to me. Go ahead.
The Neil Kinnock thing is interesting. I didn't mean to, just a slightly different valence on that is, you know, like in theory, it forced him out of that race because he plagiarized. But the sort of like subtle conspiracy, not the conspiracy, but the subtle subtext of it could be is that what bothered people about the Neil Kinnock thing is that the impression that Biden doesn't believe in anything, right? Like he's making it up, right? So like, you know, it's just like he'll just say whatever he needs to say. And I think that's like the sort of knock on Biden is I think everybody basically, I mean, Biden's popular, right? Like it's like the sort of like centrist, older caretaker, you know, American man of state, like let's just give this a try, try to be normal. I think the concern is that he'll be utterly beholden to his left flank, and I think it's a reasonable concern.
I agree. And, you know, I mean, like I said, I started the article off by saying I don't really dislike the guy. He just doesn't represent anything to me, you know? And having my first
– Well, it's not fully clear what he represents.
Having my first real interaction be with him when he took somebody else's speech. And that, by the way, that speech wasn't widely, you know, he was knocked off the front pages routinely by Margaret Thatcher. I mean – And so you're talking to a guy here that voted for both Reagan and Thatcher. I don't know if there's that many people out there, but because I
think Kinnock had not lost. I think Kinnock lost three general elections. I think he had not.
Oh, he
wasn't quite the loser that he had ended up becoming. But at the time of Biden.
No, he was the whipping boy of Margaret for sure. But anyway, but to bring it back to Joe, I mean, hey, I don't really dislike the guy either, but you're right. It's going to be interesting to see. I mean. Well, he's going to probably be a good placeholder for some people, but the progressives are going to want to take more, and we'll see how that goes.
I mean, it's going to be strange though, because I mean, like, everyone talks about, you know, they're trying to move Biden along for Kamala or whatever, or AOC or Pete Buttigieg, and it's like, well, I mean, Biden did just win this primary, and Biden is over 50% approval rating now.
Right.
You know, like it's as ridiculous as it seems. I mean, there's going to be considerable pressure to have Biden be the nominee at 82 years old in 3 or 4 years. People hail Harris, but I mean, the Democrats just had the opportunity to nominate Harris, and she finished basically in 10th place.
All I would say to that is this: in my experience in business and in life, a lot of those people that put Joe Biden in office, and this is just purely anecdotal on my behalf. I've got no scientific evidence, but. You know what? They voted against something instead of for something. And that's a very dangerous way to go, because then all of a sudden you wake up and you don't know what you got, right? You just know what you didn't want. And I think that idea tires pretty easily. So I think that ultimately it should be short-lived, because people are going to end up wanting to know what they're getting rather than what they're not getting.
Right.
Two words, buckle up, right? So, all right. Well, Kurt, thanks very much for being on. He is the senior reporter at the American Conservative. Thanks for your time, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I'm not Dan Proft. Some days I wish I was, but I am Scott Shelody, and that means nothing to most people too, right? But I am the cow guy, and you'll catch me on Fox Business News, sometimes Fox News. Bloomberg, CNBC Europe, all the likes. I know I talk about a lot of the things that we talk about with Dan's show, and I'm on Dan's show every now and again. I actually sit in for either he and Amy now and again on their regular show here in Chicago. But today, there's a lot on the docket now, obviously. We've had the impeachment or the second swing at the impeachment. And obviously the vaccine and how this rollout is happening is also front and center. And we don't, you know, now everybody's complaining about not having enough vaccines when only 4 short months ago it was you'll never have a vaccine. I think it's funny how the narrative's changed so quickly. Everybody's complaining. Dodger Stadium's empty. It's been empty for 3 days. That was supposed to be a big fulfillment center for getting the vaccine. And now everybody's in arms because they don't have enough of the vaccine that they said was never going to be here. Right? Does anybody else see that we're getting played on that? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. Does anybody else see how we're being played? It's, don't look over here. Ignore what your brain and your ears are telling, your eyes and ears are telling you. We're going to let people that were born with male genes, you know, compete against females. Has there ever been anything more idiotic? I mean, I don't know. I mean, we've talked about the lockdown. We continue to talk about lockdowns and how, you know, these economies, we don't need stimulus checks. We just need to open them up. How about that? I got a great idea. Stop bankrupting my great-great-grandchildren with all these stimulus checks. And I've said it before. Look, we talk about $1 trillion like it's nothing. Ah, that's a $1.9 trillion, no big deal. $2.2 trillion, no big deal. Do you know $1 trillion? If you put it in time, right, 1 trillion seconds ago, Neanderthals were dragging their knuckles across the plains of Europe. 1 trillion seconds is 31,700 years. That's 1 trillion seconds. And think about how we've got our great leaders in Washington throwing that around. No, not like a manhole cover, like a nickel. 31,700 years if you take 1 trillion seconds back to back. And this is what we're doing to our children. So I got an idea for you. All of the idiot savants in Washington, open up the economy. We've now got some of these states that are folding and, you know, getting rid of the mask mandate. We're slowly but surely trying to get back to a place before everybody was so scarred. But my bottom line is this. If you don't feel safe, that's okay. Don't try to make me feel not as safe as you either. Just don't go out and don't see anybody else that's been out. Common sense. I'm a common sensocrat. I'm not a Republican, not a Democrat. Common sensocrat. Common sense should rule a day, and it needs to be back to the forum. We'll take a break after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Well, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Shelley, sitting in for Dan Proft, who is named, well, the show's named after Dan. Dan, the Dan Proft Show. It's not the Cow Guy Show, but I am Scott the Cow Guy. My real name is Shelley, and I am on the various financial networks that I talk about public policy, markets, and the likes. And that brings me to the Dan Proft Show. Dan has me on a few times a month, and we get to kind of go over the coals and talk about the markets and the economy and what public policy might have to do with affecting both of those. But my next guest is a gentleman by the name of Scott McKay. He's a publisher at The Hayride and a contributor to The American Spectator. Scott, thanks for coming on the show. Great first name.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay. So I've got a little bit of a cheat sheet in front of me, and I was able to kind of peruse it last night and early today. And I think one of the things I find interesting is you're in defense of Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's kind of a fun one to talk about, and I think that that's a good place to kick off. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's not so much a defense of Marjorie and the things that she's occasionally said,
right,
as it is a defense of the idea that the Republican Party should have its own loons that it weaponizes against the Democrats.
Totally agree.
Because the Democrats have, I mean, they have a consensus of loons in their party at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and nobody has ever shouted down Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib or you know, Adam Schiff with I mean, you want to talk about conspiracy theories with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Adam Schiff is like a walking conspiracy theory. I mean, this guy has pushed, you know, all manner of insane things on the American public, and they've basically given him official cover to do it.
All without blinking. Yeah, you know, all without blinking.
Never blinking. I don't know what's up with this guy's eyelids don't work or something.
It's Marty Feldman.
He has to tape them shut when he goes to sleep. But I mean, you know, so and they, you know, they bring this guy out, and I mean, you know, here you got Eric Swalwell, who's, you know, literally sleeping with the enemy, and nobody. I mean, they, hey, would you take him off the Intelligence Committee? And Nancy Pelosi's like, surely you jest, right? I mean, the idea that that we're supposed to have these high standards for Republicans, you know, and Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't meet those standards. When you look at the Democrats, and she is far saner than the vast majority of their caucus,
and they're unapologetic about it too. I mean,
this day, no Democrat is embarrassed about Hank Johnson.
Right.
He thinks Guam's going to tip over
it's
if you put
sink.
Too many Marines
yeah.
on it.
It's
Nobody over there is, and if you say something, you know, untoward about what an idiot Hank Johnson is, then you're a racist. And
right.
it's like, well, okay, so I don't feel bad that Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, like, sounds like Gina Carano. They don't think Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. Well, maybe he didn't, right? I mean, like, to me, it's I find it ridiculous that, you know, we're going to have this conversation about her and how damaging, you know, it is to the Republic that she should be a member of Congress.
Yeah, I sense your frustration, and hopefully you sense mine as well, because, you know, I've said for a while now that it's like they don't even the Democrats don't even they don't even do these. And I'm not a crazy Republican by any means, by the way. I have voted for a Democratic president every now and again over the last, you know, 30 years. But I will say that they're not even trying to pull these things in the back room. They just do it right in front of your face and say, come and get me. They don't care. The Swalwell thing being one of them. There's no more backroom dealings. We're going to have Swalwell sleep with a Chinese spy and keep him on the Intelligence Committee. Come try to change my mind. And they just don't.
Yeah.
So it's like the party of chaos. The more they can upset your foundation, which used to be what I see and what I hear, they keep telling you, don't believe what you see. Don't believe what you hear. It's just a mostly peaceful protest. Just don't mind the inferno behind me.
Well, right. And you know, and then they'll hit you up and say, well, what you see and what you hear and what you perceive is because of your white privilege.
Oh, my gosh, you're right.
And you go, well,
indefensible.
Wait, what? Yeah. You mean like 2 + 2 = 4? And they go, well,
that's racist.
You know, that's math, and math is racist. And at some point you realize, and I guess maybe we can talk about, you know, the impeachment and some of these people that voted for it as part of this. At some point, you have to start to realize that this is not a real basketball game, okay? It's the Harlem Globetrotters versus the Washington Generals.
Right.
And you have to decide, do you really want to be the Washington Generals? Well, the GOP is the party of the Washington Generals, okay? I mean, like, you know, we're the straight man. When you go to D.C., it's no, we're going to have standards and we're going to do these kinds
That's
of things.
That's a great analogy.
And, you know, meanwhile, Curly Neal is like, okay, well, no, that was a double dribble. And that was another double dribble. And it's like, okay, they're not calling the double dribbles.
On one side.
So stop being the Washington Generals. And, you know, this is why people call you the stupid party. Well, right. You know, I think there are a lot more Republicans on Capitol Hill now than there were, whatever, 10, 15 years ago, who recognize the game and don't want to play it. And they will... You know, like you know, Lindsey Graham's transformation, I think, is a good example of this. Right?
I agree with you. I would also say that, I mean, in some of the circles I've been in, a lot of people, love him or hate Donald Trump, they don't take that away, right, whether they like him or not. But they do believe that he's been the first one that's been able to not play like the generals.
Like that's right.
Right, and that was part of his allure, right?
No, I think it was his allure, because the fact of the matter is, you know, like Trump was not the Harlem Globetrotters. Trump was, you know, Jeff Ruland and Ricky Mahorn, right?
Right.
I mean, he didn't bring a charismatic style of ball to the floor, right? I mean, like he was throwing elbows and lots of people like, all right, well, this is not.
But he wasn't playing
awesome
like the generals.
Either.
Yeah, he didn't play like the generals.
Yeah, but at least you're not standing there watching a guy with a basketball under his jersey running up and down the court. Yeah, I mean, it's different. And you know, so, and I think that's the difference between sort of the Bush Republicanism,
right,
and the Trump. And I think Trump Republicanism destroyed Bush Republicanism, and it needed to be destroyed.
So where do they go from here? Who's going to be the next guy that doesn't play like the Washington Generals?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the guy that I look at and I'm sold on, although I'm certainly not willing to say he's the only guy, is DeSantis, the governor of Florida.
Good choice.
You know, Ron DeSantis is very much a MAGA Republican, and he very much has, you know, the take no prisoners style, particularly when it comes to media relations that Trump brought to the table. You know, but DeSantis is I think a lot smarter and more disciplined, and can probably carry it off. You will get nothing from Ron DeSantis that he doesn't want to give you.
Right.
From the standpoint of a media thing, they do not put anything over on him. They have gone after him on this COVID stuff, and every time they do, he massacres them. I mean, it's just, but he doesn't do it in such a way that it's, you know, hyper vitriolic. It's, you know, it's very factual, you know, spirited perhaps, but I mean, he doesn't lose his cool, and he's very disciplined in how he does it. And I think that's the next level of this. I mean, the thing about Trump was that Trump fought these fights and didn't really have it down how it was supposed to be done. He blazed the trail. But the people that come after Trump, I think, can, you know, can refine that style of politics and improve on it and get it to the point where, you know, you don't alienate the suburban housewives. Right.
Right. There's that old saying, you know, I don't want to be the trailblazer because those guys end up face down on a puddle of water with an arrow in their back. You know, that's I want to be the settler. Right. I want to be the third guy there. I don't want to be the first guy there. And maybe,
right.
Maybe,
I mean,
DeSantis,
you know,
fills that role. Right.
Well, it's an axiom of business. You want to be the second entry into the market. Right.
Right.
And I think that you're going to see 2024 is, you know, it's the 2.0 version of MAGA, which, you know, has lots of, you know, site upgrades, right? And I think it's okay. You know, Trump learned how to do this with Twitter, and he could bypass the media and talk to the public. You know, here comes somebody else that takes that principle and then expands it into something better.
Love having you on. Definitely have you back. I really appreciate all your input. But he is Scott McKay, the publisher at The Hayride and a contributor to the American Spectator. Thanks for being on with us.
Thanks a lot. Have a good week, everybody.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. As you can tell, this is not Dan Proft. Dan Proft, quote unquote, is on assignment, right? Something probably big and important. But now they've got Scott Shelody in the sit form. That's me. You won't know that name, and that's probably good, because if somebody does come to my door and knows my real name, it's usually a bailiff or somebody or a sheriff. But I'm the cow guy, and I talk on, I'm on Fox during the week. I'll be on tomorrow probably, but also TD Ameritrade and Bloomberg and all the other financial news shows, kind of doing the rounds of public policy and finance. Which gets us to our next guest, actually. I'm going to bring on John Tamney. He's the editor of Real Clear Markets, the director of the Center for Economic Freedom and Freedom Works at Freedom Works, sorry, and author of the upcoming book, When Politicians Panicked. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
So this is great. I saw some of the things that you've talked about, and you probably don't know anything about what I've talked about. But I had a rant or kind of a little bit of a meltdown in March on Fox last year when they asked me if we lock down, what happens to the stock market? I said, if you have no economy, you have no stock markets. I mean, I hate to say it, but common sense should rule the day, and this is really, really not good. And then I got angry after the death threats, and I dove into what I thought was going to be happening, and it just. The more and more I looked at it, it said lockdowns aren't a good idea. What are your thoughts, and shed some light on the subject for us?
Oh yeah, there's this myth offered by both sides, really, that the stock market is separate from the economy, which is just so idiotic. You know, the stock market is a reflection about future prospects for the economy. It doesn't reflect the present; it reflects the future. And so, it's no surprise that when you shut down over a quarter of the world's most dynamic economy, that markets are going to be very surprised and they're going to correct. It's also no surprise that, as it quickly became apparent, that politicians had wildly overreacted, that they've done the exact wrong thing. You never destroy an economy to fight a virus, but that's what politicians did because they're just worthless in how they approach things. And so with that, markets, of course, started to price in a better future, that eventually we were going to get our freedom back that was taken from us in a way that blinded us to how to avoid the virus or to how it spread, and also blinded us, robbed us of necessary resources to fight it, assuming it need to be fought. Economic growth is the biggest enemy of disease and death,
right.
Yet politicians in their infinite wisdom chose to foist poverty and economic contraction on us and around the world as a way to fight the virus. Historians will marvel at the shocking stupidity of the political class.
I think you're right. I think that we are going to be judged so harshly, if not 5, but definitely 10 years from now. And I used to say, and I felt like I was all alone, and it sounds like, obviously, you're much smarter than I am, so you've been able to put it in better words than I could ever do, but poor economies have poorer citizens. So if you want to destroy the economy to get better, it's asinine. If you destroy the economy, you're going to have worse health care, worse hospitals, worse everything. And that is exactly the opposite of what you need to get done.
Yeah, no, it's so true. You put it so well. Let's never forget that we didn't always live this way. In the 19th century, if you broke your femur, you had 1 in 3 chances of death. And then, but if you lived, your operation was amputation. If you had a broken hip, you were going to die. Cancer, forget about it. It was a death sentence, but let's realize that most people never got cancer because tuberculosis and pneumonia and
right.
yellow fever got them first. And so why do we live so long today? Why do we die of old age? A very modern, rich country concept. Why do we get Alzheimer's? Well, we get these diseases because economic growth created the resources necessary for people to find out ways to elongate life such that we don't worry about pneumonia and tuberculosis and yellow fever anymore. And so now, because we live longer because of economic growth, we're discovering new diseases. 200 years from now, people will be laughing about Alzheimer's and they'll have discovered other things.
Right.
But again, politicians decided this time that, oh, wait, there's a virus spreading. It was very evident from China that it was many things. It was not lethal. The Chinese were not dying in any substantive fashion. But even if they had been, the last thing you would ever do is destroy an economy to fight a killer, because if there is something that's killing your people, you want the economy booming so that there's resources out there to be matched with scientists so that you can find a cure.
So you posed the question, would you support a lockdown if that meant you losing your own job? I mean, I think that's a great question, because I've said and written before that during a pandemic, everybody feels like their job is essential. So that's a great question. Would you support a lockdown if it meant losing your own job?
And I think we know the answer. I mean, Scott, let's ask the question. What if the virus had started spreading in 2000? Does anyone think that if it had spread in 2000, there would have been lockdowns? Not a chance. And why is that? Because in 2000, most people, rich and poor alike, had jobs that were destinations. So if politicians suddenly said, you can no longer support yourself, you can no longer operate your business in the way that we desire you to, people would have revolted because everyone would have lost everything. Imagine 100 years ago in 1920, we would never even have stopped to consider the virus because most people didn't live long enough to die of old age in the first place. So we would have just gone on with our lives. This was a rich country concept, as in only a country as rich as the United States could do something so shockingly stupid. And what's worse about this is consider what it meant for the rest of the world. When the U.S. acts like a complete and utter fool, we don't provide cover for the rest of the world to act wisely. And so our actions here have caused massive rushes back to poverty around the world. The New York Times has pointed out that 285 million people around the world are headed back towards starvation because this obnoxious, arrogant country that is so great but decided this time that it would bite its nails to make a few rich people feel better and destroy the lives of tens of millions of others and hundreds of millions around the world.
You know, and part of me thinks this, and I could be wrong, but, you know, the mainstream media scared everybody so much. And I think that we're still, it's going to, you know, if it took 3 months to scare everybody like they did, it's going to take 3 years to unscare everybody, right? That's going to be a long road. I feel kind of like we locked down just because China did. We didn't have a better idea. You know, China locked down, that was going to be our idea. So we copied China, and they're the ones that were the whole thing came from in the first place. It was boggling my mind at the time that we were going to actually copy what China was doing with their economy to our own.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Let's never forget that the virus has been spreading for a number of months, at least in China, and that they didn't do anything. And you could argue that that's a reason that probably a lot of Americans were already immune to it, and certainly a lot of Chinese were, because it spreads faster than the flu. And so the Chinese eventually locked down, but they didn't for a long time. And kind of to your point, so what? That's what they do. We're the United States. We do not take freedom. And that's what worries me. The thing that scares me the most, and I write about a lot in my book, is that, yeah, the numbers all work in our favor. It never made sense to overreact to something that was so meek, something that largely hits people who are already in nursing homes.
Right.
But if we make that argument, we set the stage in the future for these idiots to lock us down again. The answer, first and last beginning, is always freedom. Free people produce information about how a virus spreads. And they also just freedom is its own virtue, plus freedom produces the economic growth necessary to fight a virus if it's an actual major, major killer. And so who cares what others do? The United States doesn't lock down if this time we allowed it. And I refuse to blame the media. Look, I'm sorry. I blame people. We had all sorts of information. You did. I did. I blame a lot of Americans. Why did they allow politicians to do that?
100% true. You know what? That's a great place to stop. We're going to take a break, pay some bills. We'll be back up. Come on, baby.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back, everybody. This is The Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Shelody, in for Dan today. I'm otherwise known as the Cow Guy. You catch me on Fox and Bloomberg and CNBC Europe and the likes, talking about public policy and a lot of the lockdown and what's been happening with the pandemic. And we've been visiting with John Tammany. He's got a new book coming out called When Politicians Panicked. Get a hold of it. But he's the editor of Real Clear Markets, director of the Center for Economic Freedom and FreedomWorks. Welcome back to the show, John. We were in the middle of you were saying that you don't blame mainstream media for shutting. We're just a bunch of lazy Americans.
Yeah, I love prosperity. I know you do, too. It's a wonderful thing. It's essential. It saves lives, all those things. But I think there's always a trade-off to something. And I think one thing, the challenge of prosperity in a country like this is that we can be stupid. We can do dumb things. We can, because our technology is so advanced, we can say, especially the elites can say, oh, let's just lock down for a bit and hide out from reality because maybe the virus will get bored and stop spreading while we hide at home with our high-speed internet that will afford us, that will bring us groceries to our door by the subhumans that are out there still working,
right.
and that will bring us endless movies and TV shows that we can stream, that will bring us exercise that we can do from our home. Again, prosperity is amazing. We couldn't have done this 20 years. We couldn't have been this stupid 20 years ago because too many rich people's jobs would have been lost. Too many politicians would have taken it in a bad way. And so this is why we have to begin with freedom every time, because there probably does come a time in the future where literally politicians say, okay, everyone stay home for a bit. Let's take a break from reality. And no one would really notice the difference. But I don't want to live in a country that would take freedom, because that's wrong. Plus, when freedom is taken from us, we're blinded. We don't learn why something is spreading in the first place, and we do other dumb things. People should be free, period.
Yeah, you're so right. And looking at the 15 days to stop the spread or whatever the initial garbage was, all I know is this: is I'm not a math major, but I do a lot of math every day. And that was, we were just talking about a bell curve, and if you take the ends of the bell curve and pull it apart, yeah, you're bringing down the number of people that go to the hospital on a daily basis, but you're also elongating how long we're going to have this thing around, right? So there are consequences to either or. My question is, I mean, I come into the city of Chicago two or three times a week to do television, and I'm shocked at the in New York and New York's only got about 10% occupancy now, but the canyons of Chicago probably, let's just say, are probably only about 10% occupied now. I mean, I've been on an elevator three times a week in a big, big downtown building, and I've only since August been on an elevator with one other person once, okay? So when you have no customers in the canyons of these big cities like Chicago and New York, what happens to all these other smaller mom-and-pop shops and businesses that have needed those things to be 70, 80% full to survive? I mean, we haven't taken, in my mind, full stock of the damage that we've done to the economy. Everything's still so great because everybody is able to do Peloton at home and all these pandemic winners and a few losers. But I still say that there's a foundation here, that there's some people we haven't really taken true stock of. And there's some damage that's been done big time.
Oh, yeah, major damage. But remember, those people don't matter. See, this was a rich man's virus all along.
Yeah,
for the people that could disappear. I do think, however, that long term that's going to change. It doesn't take back the horrific damage that these morons did to a lot of good people who started businesses all over the country, who just are seeing them wiped away by just an utter overreaction and panic. But let's never forget, and you know this from working in finance, when I was working at Goldman Sachs, they made a point. They spent enormous sums of money giving new employees credit cards saying, take people out every night. Get to know the firm. We can't survive unless everyone here understands the culture, and we keep developing culture carriers. Steve Jobs built Apple's final headquarters, the one that he built, on the idea that he needed people running into each other every day. There is such value to a headquarters.
So
businesses
true.
Were not
so
doing this just to waste money, to build monuments to themselves. But, of course, idiot commentators say that, oh, yeah, people will never go back to the office again. That was implicit there.
Well, some of these CEOs are agreeing with it. Yeah, CEOs are agreeing with it.
Yeah, some are agreeing with it, and they probably will. Probably with certain aspects of businesses, they'll say, okay, we figured out a way to. But good businesses will get back to work in headquarters because that's how you grow. It was never about just wasting money. It was about successful, growing businesses, had people running into each other every day, sharing ideas, arguing. And so that's going to come back. And so eventually it doesn't save a lot of these businesses. But to be clear, this isn't me saying that these people don't matter, who've had their livelihood taken from them by sheer idiocy. But I do think eventually this is going to turn itself around.
All right. That's a great place to take a quick break. We're going to pay some more bills. We'll be right back after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show, the Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Shelley, the cow guy, sitting in for Dan. We've been talking to John Tammany. He's got a new book coming out, When Politicians Panicked. And we just real quick to pick up where we left off, because that's where I have a lot to say about it, is I think that you're right. I mean, this face-to-face, this culture, this getting in front of people, John, is a very important thing for businesses, and you just can't write that off going forward. It's going to have to happen again.
No, it is, and that gives me optimism. And it also that's what's so sad about this. Let's agree that no one needs a law to keep themselves from getting sick. No one needs a law to keep themselves from dying. There's no doubt that when the virus, quote, got here, let's be honest, it's been spreading here for quite some time just because we live in a global economy, globalized world. But anyway, once it became known to politicians and they panicked, Americans were stepping back a little as is. They weren't going out as much. They weren't going into the office as much. We were going to adjust as is. And so what happens when we spend less? We build up the capital base. You know this from finance. Our lack of spending doesn't shrink the economy. It provides capital to new ideas. It provides ways for business to figure out and devise new ways to serve us. And so if politicians had done nothing, Americans would have stepped back on their own. Their saving would have built up the capital base, and the economy would have revived itself. Compare that to what they've done. They just forced a shutdown. They opened things up and then shut them back down again. And so they've destroyed many businesses for good that could have otherwise said, hey, look, there's just a near-term pullback, but it's going to change with time once people, you know, get organized again and realize that this is not the big deal that it was. We missed a real opportunity to have a brief dip, a natural dip that would have created the momentum for a rebound.
Right. I mean, I got a lot of hate mail when I just kept saying, look, the best way to do this is not, number one, not locked down, but number two is if you feel like you're afraid, don't go outside and don't see anybody else that's been outside. Or if you've got a comorbidity or something like that, why can't we make the choice for ourselves? Well, the government didn't trust us to make the choice for ourselves. So we legislated to the lowest common denominator and shut everything down. And that was my problem. If there are still some people that complain about, you know, people not wearing masks, and why do we have to mandate everything to make sure you're comfortable, right?
Yep.
That's not right. So if you don't feel comfortable, don't go out. But again, too much common sense, and it gets me frustrated. And my blood pressure goes through the roof. But we need.
I can't talk about it without raising my voice.
Right.
I can't. I can't do it. The very people who created the DMV and the post office decided they were going to dictate to businesses how to serve their customers as a virus was spreading. Historians will marvel at the abject stupidity.
Oh, I love it.
Of what took place?
Yeah. Well, you know, here's my biggest question to you then. Look, two things. I don't understand why what the CDC says if you're under the age of 70, you basically have a 99.5% chance of surviving the virus if you get it, okay? I've never had anybody be able to answer to me why we have a vaccine for that. But that's aside. I mean, I still don't know. I mean, and I did get
Asked and agreed.
Well, here's the deal. The vaccine's not for our health. It's for our mental health. It's not for your physical health. It's just to make you feel more comfortable. It's like the bollards out in front of these buildings to make sure people think that no one's going to drive a bomb into the building, right? Even though they probably still can, it just makes you feel comfortable enough to come back to work. And that's all this really is. But my question to you, John, is how do we get back to normal? When little kids are now afraid to go outside with their masks not on, right? I mean, we have now corrupted a group of kids. That and I think largely this is the biggest effect that this has had on these children is how do we get back to some semblance? I mean, I say all the time in writing, we're never going to go back to normal. And if you have to have the mask on after you've had the vaccine, because the vaccine was supposed to be the big panacea, right? If we have to have the mask on still, that means we're going to have to socially distance still. And that means that any restaurant is only going to be up to 50% capacity still. So anybody that thinks the economy can come roaring back when we still have to wear a mask and social distancing has got a new, you know, they need to go read another economics book. How do we get back to normal?
I think we're going to get back to normal because Americans ultimately have common sense and they love to grow. And Americans are social people. They like to be around other people. You know, but you're absolutely right. This was... I think also reason's going to come back into play. You remember the 80s. You remember AIDS. You remember all the alarmism about that.
I remember Vietnam.
And now we laugh about that. Remember Anthony Fauci in the 80s said that you could get AIDS just by casual contact. How wrong he was. And so when it comes out more and more about how wrong they were this time, people are going to say, you know what? We're not going to continue to live this way. We're not going to be around people. We're going to get back to normal because yet again, politicians, when they centralize decision making, they destroy lives. Free people Free people enhance life. When politicians take control and panic, they destroy it. And if the one good thing will come out of this is that government will be discredited in such a way.
Can we
be clear about this, that we owe it to ourselves to own this narrative? People should be writing more books, more columns. We need to win this argument, because if we don't, history books will say that, yeah, a virus contracted the global economy. No, it didn't. Panicky right. politicians did.
And you know what? They took away your right to work. They took away your right to congregate. And they locked you up in
your
own
dignity.
Home. Yes. And we let them do it.
Dignity.
And we let them do
yeah.
it. We handed over the keys yeah. and says, have at it. I mean, if anybody mm-hmm. wants to take over America, we just gave the blueprint out to the rest of the world on how to do it. Scare them with a virus. Yeah. That's all you yeah, can walk right yeah. in. I mean, it's going to make France look like a big uprising, right? So
they say that the Chinese are spying us. What would they spy? What could they learn from these idiots who run this country?
Exactly.
What would you spy on after seeing this? After Americans voluntarily destroyed so much, destroyed the dignity of so many of their people. Yeah, oh, no, the Chinese did it. When I hear that, that is exactly what politicians want to do, because it takes away the blame from them. No. You losers right. panic because right. you had no sense of self, no understanding of the genius of freedom on its own. You just took away things from people and destroyed their dignity. What you did.
You didn't stand up and fight for the right to be at your parents' funeral. You didn't stand up and fight for the right to keep your business open. You didn't stand up to anything. You just let them do it. And that's what really frustrates me. And I think, you know, you obviously sound as heated about it as I get, but then we are going to be judged. I mean, and you say the absolute stupidity. I couldn't agree with you more, but I want to make sure everybody knows about your upcoming book, When Politicians Panic. This is John Tammany. It's been great having you on, John. He's the editor of The Real Clear Markets, the director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks. And don't forget that new book, When Politicians Panic. Thanks for being on, John.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
All righty.
So great. I really appreciate it.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. I say that with vim and vigor because it's fun. I'm Scott Shelley. You don't know who that is, except you might know who the cow guy is. I write for the Northwest Indiana Times at the weekends. I get a lot of great hate mail from that. I mean, Twitter and all the other things, as well as Fox Business News and CNBC Europe, Bloomberg, TD Ameritrade, RFD TV. That's a good one. I like that one out of Nashville. Anyway, but here we are. I'm with Dan, or I'm sitting in for Dan. Dan is on assignment, right? That's what we say in the business. I'm not really even in the business, but. You know, I love coming on and doing the sitting in for the show because it's also therapeutic for me. And having the likes of, say, John Tammany on is also very therapeutic. The guests that we have that come across this show help me keep my blood pressure down because we're in some crazy times, you know. And I don't understand why we felt like the best thing that we could do is to shut down the world's best economy when this thing hit. Right? I mean, in 1918, 1919, I don't care what all of you naysayers and you trollers on my, you know, Facebook and whatever pages, Twitter pages, we lost 675,000 people back in with the Spanish flu. 1918, 1919, however long it took. But we only had 103 million people in the country back then. You know, that's like losing over 2 million people today. I mean, where did we lose our spine? We all of a sudden have just given a blueprint on how to take over America to our adversaries. Just scare them with a virus. They'll lay down. You can take away their right to work. You can take away their right to congregate freely. And you can lock them up in a cell which is called their own home. Now, they think they're free. They can work via Zoom and work on the television and use the computer. But, you know, there's a lot of Americans that can't. The people in the face-to-face jobs, the people across the bar, the chefs, the guys that deliver the asparagus to the chef. What about all the people that fly the planes and run the trains and automobiles? There's a lot of America's economy that is not pandemic ready or internet Zoom ready. And I'm afraid that we haven't really taken full stock of what the damage that we've done to those people and to this economy. You know, you're getting played, and I don't want to say that like, I've got a tinfoil hat on, but it's been the biggest transfer of wealth that you'll ever see ever again in your lifetime. We don't have any mom-and-pop shops anymore. It's all gone to corporates, you know, that can handle being shut down. Main Street USA, unbeknownst to us, we're going to take away the flavor of every local town because nobody's got the bank account or the ability to suffer through being, you know, shut down for 8 months. So we're not going to have the little corner Italian shop or the different ethnicities that had their wares for sale. We're going to turn America or Main Street USA into Bed Bath and a Burger. Big box chains, big box stores and retail chains is all we're going to get. And that's sad. Back after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. You can tell that this is not Dan, this is Scott. Scott Shelley, otherwise known as the Cow Guy. I've got the pleasure of sitting in for Dan. Dan is away on assignment somewhere either tropical or very important, but I'm filling in. You can catch me on Fox Business, TD Ameritrade, a bunch of other financial television shows, but I talk about public policy most of the time, and then a little bit of finance too. But we're joined today by my next guest, Dominic Green. Dominic's the life and arts editor of The Spectator and a fellow of the – well, I don't want to go – why don't you tell us what that is, Dominic? I don't want to talk out of school, but I do actually happen to have a British passport myself, which you'll probably be shocked about.
Well, I am actually, Scott. I thought when they gave you the passport, they explained that the Royal Historical Society is a very serious body that, you know, polices the historical profession. And it's true. If you do a bit of original research and made a contribution to it, they then say you're a member. And on by doing that, they mean you have to pay them £50 a year to keep your membership up. So it's a licensing scam. But yeah, the Royal Historical Society. I don't think any members of the royal family are directly involved. I've never seen any. You know, maybe they will.
Well, funny you say that actually, because it reminds me that I'm a little late on my annual membership dues to a club that I'm a member of in London, which Prince Philip is the president of the club, and that's the Naval and Military Club in St. James's Square there. So. You'll be shocked to know that I'm actually a member there.
The lockdown. Huh? That's great. I was there, in fact, for a party a few weeks before the lockdown.
Oh, right.
This was a sort of an artsy literary party for a magazine called The Literary Review. And
sure.
You could see the expression on most of the members' faces as you know, we all arrived and were shown to the reception. They were really quite disappointed.
Well, yeah. When I open my mouth and I hear the American accent come down too, I do get a lot of side eyes too myself. So I have to kind of keep it down a little bit. But it's a great place to stay for me when I'm in town, and I do go back a lot. I lived there for 16 years, so we've got a lot of friends and now relatives actually. So it's been a large part of my professional life, actually almost half of it. But we've got you've got a lot that you've written about. But one of the interesting things is. This legal decision that one Meghan Markle has won, she's the better half of, I guess, the Harry and Meghan 1-2 punch. What are your thoughts? I mean, it's gotten a lot of press, obviously, over there, but it also has in the States gotten a lot. It's been one of the top three things that the networks have been leading off with.
Well, I have to say, I'm amazed. Or rather, I'm not amazed. I'm amazed that yet again a British judge has come down on the side of a member of the royal family. In a case which, if you or I brought it, I suspect would have gone the other way.
Agreed.
She claims that she had written a letter, you know, sent it to her father in the expectation that it would remain private. But we know I mean, this, Harry and Meghan have said this, in you know, their lawyers have said that this letter was not simply written by Meghan and sent off to her dad, as you do, you know, when you send a private letter to a member of your family. This letter went through the PR people, it went through the lawyers, it contains all this phrasing that nobody would ever use when they were writing to their parents, like, you know how the British tabloids are,
yes,
and all this, and fake news and so on. This was obviously a semi-public, semi-legal statement. And part of the confusion here is that Meghan and Harry are insisting on being ordinary people and having the privacy rights of ordinary people. And on the other hand, they are also living this very public, very staged, managed existence. And it's wonderful news that they're expecting a child. But if they then put that, you know, out in this beautiful black and white photo that's on the front of all the papers and so on here in the UK at the moment, then, you know, you are public property in a way. The judge in this case, I mean, to my mind, is basically, you know, he was neglecting his job. Mm. It's simply the case that they conducted themselves as if they were managing a show business operation, and this letter was sent out, and now they're complaining that actually, no, we weren't public figures. If it's possible to appeal this, you know, they will. But it's bad news for the rest of us.
Right, and I would say, look, as popular as The Crown has been over here, and I can't believe that I'm going to reference that, but I will. You know, it was clearly Americans will now understand that these royals have handlers, right? This isn't something that you just pop in the post, right? It just doesn't happen like that.
No, it isn't. I mean, each royal household, you know, basically it's a soap opera. It's the world's oldest soap opera, really. Each royal household, you know, each prince and duke and so on, they have their own PR team.
Right.
And the PR teams are often spinning against each other. And there is a suggestion that because one of the Queen's granddaughters, who is the daughter of the Duke of York and Sarah Ferguson, Princess Eugenie, delivered a baby just before the weekend, that that possibly the timing of the Meghan and Harry announcement was an attempt to, you know, get the attention back. And it does go on. A lot of the time there is this kind of competition between the households. But all of them are acutely conscious of this. And again, to refer to The Crown, I think in one way the latest series was a very good guide in the sense that they're enormously self-absorbed. Particularly people like, I mean, Prince Charles is a very good example. He is absolutely convinced that he should be the center of his own little world. And that, you know, he has his minions, as the Queen calls them in the series, his minions making sure that the press are on side. It's a very shabby business, really, isn't it?
Well, you know, I was born in America, and having lived in the UK, I've got the British passport as well. But I have just this unique perspective on it, right? Because a large part of me, when I hear these types of things, does what a lot of other Americans do, like, oh, who cares, right? I mean, these people were born; they won the sperm lottery, as we would say over here.
I'm not sure that Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II is familiar with that, but you know, I think it does apply. Yeah.
Yes, right. And then at the same time, because I'll flip sides and go over to your side of the argument, is that I get the feeling that he's kind of, it's like Duke of Windsor-esque almost. Like because his brother is almost perfect. He's the one that is the outward face of the firm, and he's just kind of gone off on this back. You know, backstage kind of a thing, like Prince Edward did back in the 30s and 40s. It feels like that to me, you know?
Yeah, there's two problems. I think one problem is quality control, because, you know, one generation to the next, you know, the quality, it goes up and down. There's been some really, really duff, you know, kings and queens, and some really duff members of the royal family. The other thing is there's too many of them. That, in the old days, they came and went quite quickly. From, you know, the 19th century onwards, they seem to have now lived an awful long time. And so, you know, the heir to the throne and the next one after that, there's kind of generations now, all backed up, all waiting for a seat, you know, on the throne. And so you get these kind of man children, really, which is what
Yeah, very good point. Yeah.
They're behaving like adolescents. You know, I'm waiting for mummy to die. That is not a job. It's a terror. It's a curse, really, isn't it?
Well,
and that's pretty much the dilemma.
Right. And when you think about it, this is where Americans really have to really kind of take stock, is that, you know, mummy has been Queen of England for more than 25% of the age of America.
Yeah, Mummy's first prime minister, you know, was Winston Churchill.
Yes, yes.
So that puts it back. But look, there is a positive thing to be said for monarchy, which is that it tends to control the kind of political passions that can attach themselves.
Yes.
I mean, it's hard to believe anybody would attach political passion to Joe Biden. But you see what I mean. You know, if the symbol of the state is, you know, unsatisfactory, then you know, people will be, you know, deeply unhappy in the political division. If the symbol of the state is really got nothing to do with the day-to-day running of the thing, it's just an interesting soap opera most of the time,
well,
then that actually, you know, gives people something to unite around.
Yes.
And it takes some of the steam out of political differences.
I couldn't agree more. And it felt like to me when I was there that it was they were the rudder in a rudderless society, you know, when things were kind of going off the rails.
I think so. And the problem, in a way, is it is to do because there's too many of them. Someone like Prince Harry and like his dad, Prince Charles, they keep making their opinions felt. And nobody wants to know what
nobody
they think
cares.
About the environment or organic gardens or
architects.
These are the sort of things that Prince Charles goes on about while he's waiting for the throne. And Prince Harry is like the woke prince of Bel Air, and he's telling us all not to fly on private jets. I mean, to be honest, I'm still waiting for a chance. And this is the guy who does fly on private jets.
And it's always...
And the kind of... It is that they're Hollywood affluent, and they're talking to us as if they're the man and woman in the street. And, you know, this is not going over well in Britain. And frankly, there are people who are better at doing that in the US. You know, there's a highly professional world of showbiz.
Right.
Where people are already signaling their virtues and telling us off and using the wrong kind of paper bags. You know, we really don't need to hear it from them.
All right, exactly right. Well, this is a perfect chance to take a quick break. Make sure you come back with us in a minute here. Dominic, we're going to pay some bills. We'll be back after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. This is the Dan Proft Show. One of the smartest guys I know. I usually just hold the door for Dan and let him come in, but no one else can make it through the snow today, so I've got the job of sitting in the chair. My name is Scott Shelley. I'm the cow guy. It is snowing a lot here in Chicago. I woke up to 10 inches this morning on the driveway, so it was a real joy to get in. But we're right now we're talking to Dominic Green. We've gone off the reservation a little bit, Dominic. We're talking about Harry and Meghan, and then maybe Harry's father, Prince Charles, and a lot of Americans. I mean, I was laughing before we went to break because I just keep on thinking about. I don't have any time to produce a watercolor, and somehow Prince Charles can do it all the time. I mean, right? I mean, where in my life, at the age of 55, can I sit down and say, "Honey, I'll be out I'll be out back painting a watercolor. Come get me in 4 hours." I mean, it's just not happening.
Yeah, he's apparently meant to be quite good. I mean, it's hard to know, right?
Well, after all the practice he's had, he better be. Yeah.
One gets all the good reviews. No one's going to say, you know, that's a load of rubbish. He sells them for charity. To be fair to him, he gives all the money to charity. On the other hand, he keeps the money that he makes from selling things like marmalade and cookies and so on. They're very good, I have to say. I mean, you know, Prince Charles's lines, Dutchy originals, they are excellent, to be fair to him. But he's monetizing his royalness, and which I suppose is harmless in the way. I eat the marmalade. I think it's
good. I would say that could be very democratic. If you don't like it, don't buy it, right? If you can sell it,
yeah,
good
exactly.
Luck to him.
But I don't want to be told what to think by him of all people.
No,
I don't even want to take lessons in drawing watercolors from him.
Well, but it's very interesting about the and it's still the way it is here with this news being one of the top three, if not the top things on. You know, it pushes the pandemic off top. You know, the number one story of the day is Harry and Meghan, and she's pregnant, and it comes out on Valentine's Day, just like it did Harry's mom, Diana, Princess Diana. And it's interesting when, obviously, we can talk about them ad nauseum forever and ever, amen. But again, back to this thing, I just keep feeling like he's taking an alternative route and trying to be private, but only when he wants to be, in public only when he wants to be. And he's trying to straddle two different worlds. And I end up thinking when I do that in my own private and personal or public life, I end up doing both of them poorly. What do you think?
Yes, I find exactly that. I find that every time I go to Starbucks, there is someone with a telephoto lens up a palm tree half a mile away taking that shot of me looking a bit portly and right. a bit, you know, badly dressed. But no, seriously, this is the thing, right? In Britain, you know, the press have a deal with the palace, and there is all, you know, this legal pressure as well on them to behave. And so the royals in Britain do have a certain amount of privacy. But in the US, these are just two other famous people with too much money and time on their hands. And therefore, they are subject to exactly the same rules as any other American celebrity or rich person, which is, you know, you are allowed to take their photo. And they do play the game of making sure that their photo is taken in ways that, you know, make them look good or when they have something to push. So, you know, they've made a devil's bargain, and that's that. They rely upon being famous in order to get everything else that they want, which is to, you know, tell us all how to behave. And also to make a great deal of money with it, you know, making documentaries for Netflix and so on. Well, that's the nature of the bargain. So I don't believe, really, that they have too much of a claim to privacy in this sense. They can't say turn the cameras on and off when it suits us. You know, you're either private or not private.
And Harry claims to, you know, have been deeply damaged by the press hounding his mother, and yet he's all too happy to come over here and have the press hound him. I don't understand that.
Yeah, there's something of nature of Greek tragedy about this.
No, he's like a
to enter the situation that he's been trying to escape from all his life. You know,
right, he's like a little high school girl cutting himself, right? He's like he's cutting himself.
He has found the very thing that he wished, you know, had not happened to his mother, and he has found it through somebody who he says, you know, reminds him of his mother because of her humanitarianism and so on. I mean, you kind of wish that Sigmund Freud was writing for People magazine. he'd just get it straight away. He'd do a great job with it.
Well, his brother and Kate have done, I mean, I think have, you know, they've held up their bargain and end of the bargain at least, and they're very royal, and there hasn't been, I don't think to my knowledge, anything untowards that's happened to them. They've just kind of dutifully gone along their business and are probably viewed as the golden children in the family right now because a lot would be hanging on William's chest if suddenly something happened to his father.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, totally. Back they've been wiping the floor with Harry and Meghan. It has to be said, you know, they have gone, you know, to the nation's hearts by just basically being reliable parents of small children. You know, that's all they had to do.
Yeah, they're like the accidental royalists. They've just kind of backed into it by just behaving, right? And they haven't done anything done anything too crazy. I found that very interesting because, I go back to that Duke of Windsor, because it just feels like Harry and Meghan are just kind of feeling their way through. This has never been done before. They've got a foot in both camps. And when that happens, you don't do either one of them very well. And now we've got this legal opinion. And you're right. If I know that they've got handlers, and this has been gone through the wash with all the handlers, yet it's supposed to be private. I mean, it's just this is just going to keep going on, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
It is. I'm afraid that they have, as you know, when someone flips you off, you don't necessarily want to get into it with them unless you're prepared to escalate it. And they have, you know, basically declared war on British tabloids, who are, of course, highly professional. And their job is to, you know, get those photos, get those stories. And this is going to be a very cruel and nasty fight. And it's not, you know, I mean, Princess Diana famously, you know, tried to control the process and strike a deal and so on. This isn't going to be like that now. This is an open declaration, basically, from Meghan and Harry saying, you cannot practice your job as you would like, and we're going to use every means at our disposal to make sure that you can't. And the papers will only respond to that for what it is, which is a threat to their sales figures, to their existence. And so, you know, when they come back to Britain, they're not going to be cheered by the press. They're going to be subject
exactly
to the
my thoughts.
Heat of this.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's going to leave a mark, right? That's what we would say here in the States. Like, you just can't unring that bell, right? I mean,
no, and they've chosen this. They've chosen to fight it out. They could just have risen above it, because everybody knows today's newspaper, as they say in England, is tomorrow's chip paper. You know, you wrap fish and chips in yesterday's newspaper.
Right.
It's possible for the royals to rise above it, as often they do. The Queen does not ring up, you know, when the BBC has someone on with an opinion about her. She doesn't ring up and say, you know, I disagree. this is what really happens. You know, you roll with it.
All right,
the same
I have
reason as Tom Cruise does not bring up and complain.
Right, I have a press pass, and one thing I learned, I have an English press pass, right? So you can get through the barriers at Downing Street and the likes. And one thing I did learn is they don't give any oxygen to any story, no matter how bad it is. They just let it live and die and get wrapped with the fish and chips the next day. They don't dispute. They just let it go.
Yeah, and this is one thing that has happened to the royal family, which is it's become a form of entertainment rather than just a symbol. Mm-hmm. And it's something that's happened also, you know, across the board in the way that a lot of politics, a lot of public life has been turned into sort of entertainment, a WWF kind of face-off.
Right.
Well, if Harry and Meghan want to get in the ring with the papers, they will lose. Because they have more to lose.
And I don't think...
And it'll be unpleasant.
You know what? This has been fantastic, Dominic. I don't think they know that, though, but we're going to have to leave it there.
I keep trying to tell them. I just don't
feel they're listening. Right. Give him a bell on his cell phone. He'll answer, I'm sure. Well, thank you, Dominic, for taking the time with us. It's Dominic Green. He's the Life and Arts Editor of The Spectator. Thanks very much for your time today, Dominic.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. Crisscrossed in the wrong direction. Found myself in a conversation from a missed connection.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. This is The Dan Proft Show. I'm Scott Schellady, sitting in for Dan today. Dan is on assignment someplace where it's not getting 15 inches of snow. So I'm glad to be here. You'll catch me as Scott the Cow Guy, not Scott Schellady, really, and I'm glad that people don't know my first and last name properly. But I'm on Fox Business News, Yahoo, sometimes CNN, believe it or not, and all of the basically the financial television news shows out there to talk about public policy in the markets, more public policy rather than anything else. But public policy is a thing, and our next guest is Christopher Bedford. He's the senior editor at The Federalist, the vice chairman of the Young Americas for Freedom, and the author of The Art of the Donald, Lessons from America's Philosopher-in-Chief. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, going down the list of things to talk about with you, just don't get weird, but my mouth waters because there's so many good ones to talk about with you, but why don't we kick off with the life of a brewery and what LA's ever-shifting COVID-19 response has done to it.
So Los Angeles County is the biggest county in the country, and it's also about the most one of the most restrictive counties right now still on COVID. There are not a lot of other counties out there, for example, that still do not allow any people to go inside of restaurants or breweries or bars at all. A lot of places have gone to maybe 25% capacity, like we've seen in New York City, or like a lot of the free states out there are completely open. Now, LA, because it's so big, there's whole different climates in that county. If you're down in the city, it's 65 degrees and it's sunny and you're by the beach and it's pretty nice. But north of the mountains, where a lot of county, like a number of towns are, and a lot of breweries and some wineries, it's high desert, it's cold, it's windy. So I've been talking to some of the brewers out there and some of the people who own vineyards out there, folks who are just trying to get by and follow the rules. And they're watching as cold climates come in, as their tents are torn apart, and even worse than that, as they are frequently harassed by city health inspectors who come out from Los Angeles, about 70 miles away or about 70 minutes away. They come up, and they don't even always know the rules. And when they come in with their clipboard, they will shut you down for things that they are completely wrong on. And it may take you an hour or two to convince them, including calls to their supervisor, that they're wrong. And then they'll just leave. But in that period of time, your customers are stuck there. No one can do business. It's almost like the county really doesn't want their businesses to succeed at all.
And why do you – I mean, this has been something that I've had a big problem with across the country. And you started off by talking about, hey – you know, they don't have any indoor dining. Why are they so strict? They don't even have the 25% capacity. You know, my argument has always been, you know, I have friends that have restaurants, and they need to be 75 to 85% full to make any money. 25% capacity just makes me go out of business slower. And then now, like Governor Murphy of New Jersey allows people to be up to 35% capacity. Thank you for slowing down me going out of business, but I'm still going to go out of business. I mean, the very fact that these people are going around and with a wave of a pen and not even knowing the rules and shutting these people down, I just – it's so un-American to me, and I would never have believed it 2 years ago. Never in a million years that would I believe that America would be able to shut off their small businesses.
Yeah, 2 years ago, I did not believe that our mayors and our governors, who typically have an interest in their town beyond national politics, would be so willing and so callously destroy their own economies. And never did I believe that the American people would take it like this. But it's been such a slow boil where everyone was supposed to be on board and everyone at first was really worried about this. And then as the information started to come out, that maybe this is not the bubonic plague, you should be careful, but it's not the bubonic plague, people were already in this mode. You know, just yesterday, I went by for lunch at a great Irish bar in D.C. called The Dubliner that holds one of the best St. Patrick's Day parties I've been to outside of Boston and New York. And this place, and of course, I've not been to St. Patrick's Day in Chicago, and that's a pilgrimage I have to make someday. They got to be at 25% capacity. No one at the bar. They can't have live music. They can't have people standing. I mean, the manager said to me, to be honest with you, it's going to be pretty dour in here. It's not going to be like it was before. And they got shut down just before St. Patrick's Day last year by COVID. These are their two biggest day, the biggest year of 2021, their biggest day of 2020. Now, meanwhile, across the river, about a 15-minute drive away, you can go to Northern Virginia, and there's live music, there's 50% capacity, and there are some people at the bars. This is just a stone's throw away, and that's the difference in regulation. And these bureaucrats are so obsessed with their power that they don't even care about that.
Yeah, there was some places in some counties in, say, even Indiana that borders Illinois where it was okay to get your haircut on one side of the street and then not okay to get your haircut on the other. And I was so adamant that that was not going to ever happen in my America. It made me sick to my stomach that people rolled over and took it so well. And back to your analogy, we're going to take a break after this, but we'll be back in a second. But I'll just get in there that we all started off as frogs in this warm water, and they slowly turned up to boil, and none of us hopped out. We'll be back after this.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. This is Scott Shelley, the cow guy sitting in for Dan Proft for the Dan Proft Show. There's no cow guy show yet, maybe. Who knows, right? But I'm on with Christopher Bedford, the senior editor at The Federalist, the vice chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom, and the author of The Art of the Donald, Lessons from America's Philosopher-in-Chief. And we went to break, or I kind of went to break, by saying that, to your point, we all thought this was going to be 15 days to flatten the curve. We didn't realize it was going to be, stay locked up into your house until you accept communism. So we've really just been all frogs in warm water, and they've turned up the boil, and we haven't really hopped out.
And look at what, for example, the Chicago teachers are just asking for the union in order for them to go back to work. I mean, an end to racial injustice before I go back to work? What are you, 13 years old? Go to your room. I can't imagine that these people are teaching our children with these wild demands. I'm waiting for Dr. Fauci to say, well, in order for the schools to be safe, we need a $15 minimum wage.
Right.
Something that might work in Chicago, but certainly wouldn't work in West Virginia. These are the kind of demands that we're getting. A radio program I listened to out of Boston for some Celtic radio says that the next public health crisis related to COVID is driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. It's a public health issue. There's no end to the greed that people have been doing. And in the same time, entrepreneurs, friends of mine who own bars and restaurants, event spaces, breweries, they're getting destroyed by this. And it's so sad.
We don't take enough stock in that. I have to get it in almost in every segment. But, I come down to the city 2 to 3 times a week in the canyons of Chicago, which are much, much like the canyons of New York's in the financial district. And these skyscrapers, I mean, I've been doing this now since August. I ran away to Scottsdale, Arizona during the pandemic. And I've been in these buildings 2 to 3 times a week since August. And one time and one time only have I ridden an elevator with another person. They're empty. And so if you've got the canyons of our great city centers empty and people aren't coming back to work in these offices again, what happens to all of those businesses? There's 3 to 4 or 5 businesses sometimes on the concourse level of all these big buildings that are just not coming back.
there's a huge amount of blight, and I fear that a lot of this, I think, has been partisan, and a lot of it's also been just fear-mongering. And what they're going to end up doing is turning our cities into urban blight, the kind of way that we used to see in the 60s and the 70s, and where they would be dangerous places. Just here in Washington, where there's both political pressure to not crack down on crime and the kids aren't in school, it's been an unreal rise in crime. What used to be car break-ins and occasional late-night muggings have now become armed carjackings of people with their children. It's just frightening. This is on Capitol Hill, and this is the kind of thing that drives people out of the cities. And we've seen such a great rejuvenation of the cities in the last 20 years or so, where they've become wonderful places for families, things that you wouldn't have imagined in the 70s. Right. And now I think we might lose that.
People were willing to pay a premium because of the nightlife and the culture and sometimes the beauty of living in the city, right? The lights, and it was all worth it, that premium that you had to pay to have everything that nice at your fingertips. But when you take all that away, just forget about maybe the danger aspect, but when you take all of that away because of COVID lockdowns and all the new rules, what's my premium go for? What I can't go to a restaurant. I can't go to the theater in New York. I can't do anything. And now on top of that, I can't go out because I'm afraid of getting carjacked. And we don't have any police to look after them because the police have been defunded. I mean, where does this nightmare end? That's my question. What do you say?
I wish I knew. I'm trying to go out tonight with a friend who left for Montana when COVID started. He's back for the first time. And the three favorite places that we've always been going to for 10 years are gone. They had to pack up their businesses and leave. I think that there will be a large urban flight if there's not a massive turnaround on this. I was hoping, even though I think it was kind of cynical, that the whole country would just begin to open up immediately after Donald Trump had lost the election and Joe Biden was in, and they could just kind of check some of this at the door. But I'd encourage anyone who hasn't had the chance who's listening to try and get out of Chicago and get out of the areas, get out of the suburbs and go cross country. If you drive through South Dakota right now, for example, that's actually pretty cold, maybe a little further south, then through Texas, Florida, these places are open. There's music in the streets. There's children sitting on Santa Claus's lap. The elderly and the people with young children will sometimes be wearing masks, but they'll be out and they'll be eating and they'll be dining. A lot of the country is free. We're living in two different Americas. And also, it's a great time to visit national parks because there's not a lot of buses going through there.
Right. And you know what else I think is a big positive of this is that all these people that we thought were so bright that we elected to some of these offices, i.e. governors and mayors, now have had to take a class in basic economics. And they love their newfound powers of shutting everything down and being king or queen, whomever you may be. But now they've suddenly found out that, hey, if I shut everything down, I don't get any taxes, right? I can't. There's no economic activity to tax. So the municipal tax I used to raise from all these thriving businesses in my little local economy are gone. Oops. So now I'm I've got everybody locked down. I've got them all scared, but I've got no money to pay for any services to the people that need it. So I was shocked and surprised to hear that they were shocked and surprised that, wait a minute, if I shut my economy down, I don't have any tax revenue to spend. I mean, it was like it took them a while to open their eyes to that fact, maybe 4 or 5 months.
You'd think that Art Laffer's curve might have been something that was kind of more broadly accepted as generally true these days.
Right,
if you destroy the economy, you don't get money out of it.
Yeah.
Just across the river in Virginia, the governor's now talking about taxing some of the federal money that's going to aid businesses that are struggling. So
if the
federal government gives you $100,000 or $10,000, he's going to tax that. It's taxpayer money that's going as federal relief, and he wants to take his hands in it because he's destroying his businesses. That shouldn't be allowed.
No, it shouldn't. And these are the things, I mean, the unintended consequences of their behaviors. You know, we've got, I lived 16 years in Europe. You can't find a person behind the counter there because the hourly wage got so expensive, they all went mechanized, right? So you punch in your own menu now, your own order into a flat screen, and here it comes. Well, the problem with that, we have a knock-on effect here that these guys better be careful about, whomever's running these governors or these mayors. When you mechanize all the people behind that counter, you don't have a person to tax anymore, right? There's no...
You don't have anyone to tax.
Right.
And you know, it's a broader problem and it's a bigger discussion, but there's certainly a fear between the mechanization at the lower levels, the mechanization in industry, and even the self-driving cars and the self-driving trucks, the cabs, the truck drivers, the trains. But there's a future in the country where people who are low skilled, which is a lot of people,
yep,
will have a very difficult time finding employment, and will end up with a very difficult situation. A lot of people who are dependent because they can't compete.
Thanks for being on. That's Christopher Bedford, the senior editor of the Federalist.
Great to join.
Thanks for being on, Chris.
Of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I am not Dan Proft. I am Scott Shelody. I am otherwise known as Scott the Cow Guy. I think my Twitter's at the Cow Guy or at Scott the Cow Guy. But you'll find me if you just Google it. It'll come up someplace. But yeah, I'm sitting in for Dan. Dan's on assignment somewhere secret and digging up some great information. But I'm on – I do the rounds on the financial news networks talking about the economy and public policy and markets and how public policy may or may not affect the markets. And that's how I get to sit in on the show every now and again, and I absolutely love it. So the first thing I'm going to say is thank you for your time and listening to my diatribes and all the great guests that we've had on today. Because they're all much more intelligent than I am. I'm just kind of like the guy that says, table for two, we'll seat you over here there, by the window. Sure, what would you like to drink? That's what I do, right? I'm the guy that kind of tries to keep it all flowing. But it was fantastic to be on. And I've talked about we've talked to some guys and some material that can be a little bit of a downer, maybe. All needs to be talked about. But I would also like to kind of leave it on an up note. I mean, we've got such an amazing opportunity. There's so many amazing, great people that we've got in the country. As one of the guests had mentioned about DeSantis, he could be somebody that could take up the mantle. And again, that's a very true business axiom. You don't want to be the first. You don't want to be the first guy there. You want to be the second and third guy there, right? You want to be the settler. You don't want to be blazing the trail because those guys end up hurt. And that's probably what happened, most definitely what happened to Donald Trump. And now we've got some people that can come in behind him and really take up the reins. And we'll see how Trump reacts now that he's through this last impeachment. And again, what I don't like about all this is, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that he was not going to be impeached. But you know what? They wanted to be vindictive. And, America can take a lot, right? We can handle a bully a little bit. We can handle, a baby throwing their toys out of the pram, but one thing we don't handle very well is people that are vindictive and just mean. And I think that a large part of this was just vindictive and just mean. They just don't like the guy. And that's the problem when you just don't like something. And I've said this earlier in the show, is that you have to be very careful about what you vote for, because you want to vote for something. You don't want to vote against something, because when you vote against something, you don't know what you're getting in return for voting against. And I think that that's where we find ourselves here today. In my business, again, I've said it before, if you don't like what I do, that's great. Come to me, tell me what you don't like, and tell me how you think you can fix it. Give me the solution. Just don't be saying no to everything, right? You ask your wife where you want to go to dinner, and you give her seven things, and she says no to all of them. Well, how about you tell me where you'd like to go this time? And I think that's what we need more of. And so instead of saying no to everything and being the politics of no and voting against, let's start voting for something, right? Let's start voting for something. So come to the table with where you want to go to dinner, and come to the table with where you know that you have the solution to the problem. And I think that's going to make it a much more palatable place to live and get some quality things done, because we have some things that definitely need to be getting done. So been a pleasure to be on with you today. Have a great rest of the week, and good luck.
This is the Dan Proft Show.